Accession number 30493, reel number one.
Ron Gray, reel one. If we could start with when and where you were born.
Born in London, yes, 2820.
Which area?
That's about all I remember. I think it was Hackney. I never really discovered much about that period of my parents' life, so that's all I've got to say, really.
What did your parents do?
My father, now it's interesting, there's this interview coming up. My father went right through the First World War, and I never discovered the history of it until I looked it up myself during the Second World War. Isn't that extraordinary? But there we are, it's a familiar story. Our old soldiers just didn't want to express what they'd been through after a war. And that's the same today, I guess, for the guys coming back from Iraq and Abyssinia and Afghanistan. Now, he ended up a sergeant, but somewhere I've got a list of all the battles he was in, so he really had been through it, and he survived. He just never, ever talked about it. But this is interesting, what he did do was there's a publishing firm called the Caxton Publishing Company, and they issued four or five volumes about First World War, and their salesmen, they never sold their books through the shops. Their salesmen ran around on doorsteps buttonholing old soldiers, and these poor guys were trapped into a year's payments on a set of books they probably never read. But I tell you what, it had dozens and dozens of the most horrifying war pictures, and I used to look through those war pictures, and the mud, the tanks, the men, the faces of those men. And I grew up with a horror of war for, honestly, a boy dipping into those books. You just never wanted to be in a war. So when World War II broke out, the last thing I wanted to do was be a soldier in the trench. So this really, now, you see, I volunteered for the Second World War. I didn't wait to be called up. But why? Out of fear. I volunteered so I could choose what service to be in. Now, I choose the artillery because I thought they'd be several miles back from all those terrible photos I've seen of infantry warfare. I thought I'd be an infantry man. But the good thing about it was that as a soldier in Italy, I was always aware of what the infantrymen were facing. Several times in my diary I'd say, poor PBI, poor bloody infantry are out there, they're doing the fighting, we're just pumping off the shells to protect them, there we are. That was a good contribution my father made, I think, to my understanding of war.
Did your mother work?
Sorry?
Did your mother work?
I don't think. My father married in, well, obviously, about when he came back from war, 1919, I suppose. And I followed in 1920, and then I had a younger brother 2 or 3 years later. My mother never worked, no. She was Irish, so I'm part Irish, I'm happy to say. Very pleased with that. And in fact, our business, a book-selling business, was sold to an Irish company on block, and I'm happy about that too. So my mother never worked, no. But she was a big influence, shall we say, culturally. She was the one The first time I ever cried in my life, I was sitting with my mother, read me a book, a Hans Andersen story about the little match girl. I just let it suck in my memory. It's the book that made me first cry over a printed word, you know. So, no, she's a very, very sensitive, nervous woman. And that's it. But she never worked. My father, he set up his own business after the war. As a greengrocer, fruit and vegetables. And when I left school, this is very important in my life, really, I left school at 14 and a half. Now that, there was no reason why I shouldn't have gone to university, really. For some years I was very frustrated by that, but now I do believe it was a good thing. I didn't go to university. I really do. I was always top of the class in written exams. I mean, well, not top, but I mean, always in the first two or three. But then the government believed the theory of a professor, oh, his name I always forget, Burt. I think it was Burt, Professor Burt. He was the one that persuaded the government to bring in intelligence testing. Now, that was sprung on us. Suddenly, you know, the written part of the exams, no problem. And suddenly, we were told to get on a train, go off to a nearby town, Lewis, actually, which was a journey then, you know, 14 years old. Not like today where travel is nothing. You get on a train, then it was something in your life. My father went with me. I went to this strange place, this strange school. I was sat down, and before all these young kids were put these questions, which are all trick questions, you know, aren't they? Once you know the trick, you sail through them. Then it was baffling. So because of that, because of Professor Burt, I never went to university. Now, Professor Burt was utterly and totally found out after the war. His secretary had done some so-called research, and between them they cooked up all these statistics about intelligence testing. And it was totally disgraced, discredited, I'm happy to say, but rather late in life to do me any good.
Had you enjoyed school?
Oh, absolutely, yes, I did, yes. I liked the practical side of it, woodwork. I was very good at that. But also, there was a sort of a class magazine which I brought out and asked for other guys to contribute to, but it ended up with me writing it from cover to cover. It wasn't much of a reflection of school life, and of course the nice thing was that it was Hove. I went to school in this Hove school, and the Hove Public Library was just down the road. So I used to, I was in and out of the library pretty often. But I think that's another important factor in my life, really.
What do you remember from school in terms of the teachers and the discipline and the methods?
Ah, yes, that's an interesting question now. There are three teachers I can remember. First, the woodwork teacher, who was a really nice guy and very encouraging and maybe enthusiastic about woodwork. Now, the other guy is a bit of a monster, I remember. He exists as a sort of a hate figure. Now, he liked to be called Captain Forward. He'd been in the First World War, and he had a very red face and a very beefy manner and a sort of brutal way of behaving, which I certainly haven't forgotten. Now, the other teacher was a nice, kindly sort of guy, and he would invite two or three lads who were promising, I suppose, to go to his home for a bit further teaching in the evening. And I took advantage of that. I remember him sort of favourably, whereas I remember the Captain Ford as a fearsome figure all these years later. But generally, I think I enjoyed being educated. But as I say, I think if I'd gone to university, I'd have been an entirely different person. I might even have ended up as an officer in the army. What a hideous thought.
Had you had a particular career in mind as you went through school?
No, that's a bit strange, isn't it, really? I don't see the trouble. My parents didn't seem to be... I didn't seem to be very helpful, frankly, looking back. And I left school... I go work for my dad, you see. So I think, looking back, of course, that was very useful. I learned about money, about confronting people, dealing with people. I used to adopt techniques of how selling more fruit and vegetables. I used to cycle around Southwick, Sussex, knocking on doors and recommending us. That was quite educative, really, looking back. But also, it gave me my own private leisure time. My carpentry ended up with me building a canoe, for instance. There was the sea, shore out, you know, Brighton Hove, Southwick Shore, and there was the sea inviting me. And I built this canoe, and then I added sails to it. I sailed up and down the coast. Now, all this came very useful when I got into the army. If teenage kids today could do what I did as a teenager, I was a keen cyclist. You know, as a result of the sea there, I became a really good swimmer. And so really, I was really physically fit. This is a time when thousands of British people were out at work, and a lot of kids were just starving. And when they were called up for the war, a large percentage of them, people don't realise this today, they were rejected because of the terrible diet and the awful conditions they lived under. Now, I haven't forgotten, I never forgot that, really. I ended up in the army really fit and sort of ready for army life and whatever it brought for me. It was just as well, because suddenly, you know, the good thing about the army was you met every kind of person, you know. It was a collective. It's all any army boat would tell you this now, of course. You were really part of you were part of the nation, you know, in uniform. And you met thousands of guys you would never have met previously, you know, you're all mixed up, every part of Britain, and a lot of them were kids who'd, young men who'd been in the coal mining, and their fathers had been in steelworks, which is all gone, they've all gone now, of course.
You'd moved to Hove after living in London?
Yes, I... yes, we lived in Portslade. You've got Brighton, Hove, Portslade, which is right opposite the great gasworks and a power station, which, by the way, the Germans were after soon after the war broke out. And then there's Southwick with the harbour, and then there's Shoreham, and then the river Arun. Ada goes up from there. And of course, that's the coastline. I explored all the rivers by canoe along the south coast there.
That was all by yourself, was it?
Yes, I was a lone wolf. I did have a mate. Occasionally we went out together. It was a two-seater canoe. And occasionally... but really... I did fall... that would bring sex into it, of course. I did fall really horribly in love with a woman who was a luscious young woman who worked for my father. It was a perfectly natural process. Somebody was 16 or 17, suddenly fall in love with somebody who was round the shop every day. And the trouble is she had a boyfriend who was 3 or 4 years older. And although she came out with me and regularly to the cinema, and we used to indulge in necking and cuddling, and I was really head over, you know, teenage love, it's so painful. Anyway, this hard boyfriend told me this, she's my girlfriend, you know, and you keep away. So that was a terrible time, really, and I decided there and then I would never ever fall in love again. I think this is a common teenage experience, you know. However, yes, I was a pretty low wolf, cycling and canoeing, and but it was a very active life, and I don't regret it at all.
What sort of community atmosphere did the Brighton area have at the time?
The time, you mean when the war broke out?
Before the war, as you were growing
before,
up.
Before, growing up. Well, you know, teenagers living in a sort of private world. Well, you see, I realised going to the library, I used to get out these big bound volumes of the Boy's Own paper. And I would read these stories of adventure and war and, you know, Never My Care adventures. And I suppose I lived that fantasy world a bit, which is why. And then I read Bevis, The Story of a Boy, by Richard Jefferies. Now, Richard Jefferies, great writer, naturalist writer. And he wrote this book, and he wrote the book from the viewpoint of a young man, of a boy, of young men, who had this marvellous liberal father who just let them get on with it, never interfere with their lives. And there was just a big pond in this man's garden. He allowed the kids to have their fantasy life, building a raft and having wars and adventures in the woods around. And that made a big impact on me. You know, it's another influence of a book on my life. I'm sure I was trying to live that, you know, building a canoe and all that stuff. I lived a sort of fantasy life, I think, to some extent. And I, because it was that's the lone wolf side of me, you see. but that all disappeared when I was just one of millions in the army. I had to adapt pretty smartly. The atmosphere. I can't say, as I say, I was living in the age, you know, teenagers have got their own private world, all of them, I'm sure of that. It's, you know, when 20 comes, well, things might change. And this, for me, 20, well, I was actually still 19. Dunkirk happened, just like that, out of the blue, it seemed. I must have known that the Spanish Civil War was going on and that there'd been a war. Mussolini had gone to war in Abyssinia. It must have all sort of flitted through my memory. But as to a deeper understanding of all that, no, not when you're a teenager. But Dunkirk, I saw the defeated armies landing in Shoreham Harbour. My dad's shop was just across the road from the harbour. I walked across the road, leaned over a wall, and there they were, little boats coming in, you know, the famous little boats ferrying the defeated troops from the beaches of Dunkirk. And I saw the faces of that defeated men with me today, without their rifles, without anything. And they looked defeated, a defeated army. Now, what could I do? That very night, I went off to the town hall and said, is there anything I can do? And the guy said, you go up to the park, he said, and I'll see the park keeper. He'll have something for you. So I went up to the park, saw the park keeper. He said, ah, yes, he said, we're about to dig a trench across the park to stop Nazi gliders landing. He said, it's all marked out, I'll get you a shovel. Can you believe it? And across the green sward, I could see the tennis courts. This is the day of Dunkirk. Tennis players in their immaculate whites banging the ball back and forth, in total oblivion, apparently, to the fact that we were defenceless. I heard Churchill make his speech, I think, probably the next day, wasn't it? We'll fight on the beaches, we shall never surrender. And I jumped on my bike and cycled into Brighton and volunteered for the Royal Artillery. What else could a young man do?
What had been your reaction to the start of the war?
The start of the war? Well, I did say this sort of teenage oblivion, you know. You have to take that into account. It explains a lot of what's wrong with Britain today at the moment. All this. Teenagers go through that phase where they're so totally selfish, and but the war does suddenly change you overnight, as it obviously did for me there. What else is to say, really?
You'd mentioned earlier that you had reading the journals about the First World War that turned you against it.
Yes.
Did you have any sense of
what? No, I see what you mean, yes. I had this image of wars as a hideous, hideous, hideous thing. But I've seen a defeated army landing in Shoreham Harbour, and I'm aware suddenly that Hitler is just across the channel. I mean, I have good imagination. I suppose I've always had a very good imagination, and I had this image, like as a dropout. I mean, one good thing when you say about awareness of the war. When it broke out, my father had been a Daily Mail reader. In fact, I remember him telling me that Oswald Mosley's got some good ideas, him and his black shirts. Well, I didn't have any view of Mosley one way or another at the time. But when the war began, I began taking the Daily Mirror. Now, the Daily Mirror was very good at exposing the appeasement of Hitler, which all the other newspapers were behind. And they had a marvellous cartoonist called Zeck. And his cartoons were, each cartoon was worth 1,000 words. It punched home the threat of Nazism that had to be fought. And that must have made a big impact on me. These visual cartoons in the Daily Mirror. But it was totally behind Churchill, of course. He was very much aware of the growing Nazi menace, and he'd been ridiculed. And it was the appeasers who controlled the press and the parliament, and it was a terrible time, pleasing Hitler. Now that all suddenly came together at Dunkirk, and I imagined Nazi bombers and paratroops coming over at any moment, when in fact, of course, straight away Nazi fighters, Messerschmitts, came chasing down, shooting up the south coast, and then racing back to France before their petrol ran out. But the war became very, very real at that moment, and I just thought, God, if I'm going to die in this war, I want to be fighting back in a uniform, not just a victim. So that sums up that moment of deciding to volunteer, I think.
You'd mentioned the appeasement of Hitler. Did you have any sense, perhaps earlier during the 30s, as the country headed towards war, of what the general public's attitude towards war as a whole was?
No, as I say, don't forget, I keep reminding you that teenagers live a fantasy world. They're not really aware of what's happening in the world. I mean, these headlines. I mean, another important thing is that the press was 90% conservative from behind Neville Chamberlain and appeasement, and everything was played down. We'd never got the truth. I mean, it was when that dawned on me during the war. It's what turned me strongly to the left, because the extent to which were the British people had been betrayed by their leaders, by the people who own the press. It's a terrible story, and of course Michael Foot and Iron Bevan brought out this pamphlet, Guilty Men, and it sold millions and millions of copies, went reprinted one after the other, and they chronicled the appeasement of Hitler, where they sold out Chamberlain and enabled Hitler to get arms, and it's a horrendous story, and now of course there's a great library of books about it, you know. It's a shameful period of British history, it really is. It all came to a crunch in 1940, with Hitler just across the Channel, and the whole of Europe occupied by the Nazis. An unforgettable moment, really. I thought it was all over. I expected to die without any doubt. Quite definitely at 20, I thought I was going to die in this war.
To what extent did the public as a whole at that stage expected a German invasion?
Well, I think what hit the headlines was the Blitzkrieg, you see, sweeping across Europe, unstoppable. I mean, the headlines were terrifying, you see. I mean, they couldn't pretend anymore. Suddenly, it was Churchill who spoke up for the British people, not Neville Chamberlain, his gang. Gang, that's what they were, horrible. Let it all happen. It could have been stopped, that war, you know. It could have been stopped if we'd helped the Spanish people fight Hitler and Mussolini. It wasn't Franco they were fighting, it was Hitler and Mussolini. We betrayed the Spanish, we betrayed the Czechs, we betrayed one people after another. It's a tragic story. As I say, it's there now in the history books, but I can still relive all that time quite easily in my memory. To what extent? Well, I mean, there were always two Britons, you know. There was one Britain that never accepted the appeasement of Hitler. There's nobody to speak up for them. Strangely, it was Churchill, who was quite a right-wing conservative without any doubt whatsoever. But he could see an enemy when he saw one. And he did provide this leadership, which was so essential at that time. Somebody who spoke out loud and clear. They're wonderful, really, looking back. Since all before had been confusion and no leadership, you know.